is nothing but one big cruel joke, and there is no hope for mankind. A guarantee that evil will ultimately be defeated. They say evil is real. Okay? Philosophy professors will try to say, well, you know, if Christianity is true, then this particular thing would be evil, and I don't think God would allow this evil. Look, it is evil. Okay? It's a product of evil. When human beings cannot see, that's a product of evil. It doesn't mean that that blind person did something wrong to bring it on themselves, but it means if Adam and Eve did not fall in the garden, all human beings would be able to see now. Okay? So we see people die, we see death and human suffering. That's not the way things ought to be. Okay? Those are products of evil. Evil is real. It's not just something for philosophers to talk about. Well, that would be evil if God existed. No. Evil really does exist. Problem is, once you acknowledge the existence of evil, once you acknowledge the existence of the crooked line, then you're acknowledging the existence of the straight line. Evil is a lack of a good that should be there. It's a perversion of that which is good, a corruption of that which is good. So atheists like to deny the existence of real evil. But the fact of the matter is, any worldview that tries to explain evil out of existence is a worldview that should be trashed immediately. Okay? Hey, whenever I debate atheists, they'll always tell me about some young guy on his deathbed, dying of AIDS. And, you know, they'll act like they're educating Christians when they talk about people suffering in hospitals and stuff. It's like, what are you talking about? Christian pastors go to hospitals. Christians build the hospitals. Okay? Why is the Red Cross? It's the Red Cross, and it's not the red swastika. It's not the red hammer and sickle. There's a reason why it's the Red Cross, okay? So, you know, they act like we don't even know about this stuff. Look, if it wasn't for evil, we wouldn't have our Bibles today. If it wasn't for the real problem of evil, not a hypothetical problem, but a real existential problem of evil, then God would, you know, if it wasn't for Genesis chapter 3, the fall of mankind, God would not have had to write the Bible to tell us the solution to the problem of evil. So, basically, evil is a real problem. What solution does the atheist offer to us? There is no real solution to the real problem of evil. Feelings of guilt. You know, I used to think this was a weak argument or a weak clue for God's existence until I started reading Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud believed and said, oh, me and my colleagues, we're brilliant. We know that God doesn't exist. Now, how come 95% of the world disagrees with us? And so Sigmund Freud set out, he devoted his career to trying to explain, trying to prove why 95% of the world is neurotic or psychotic. Okay? You know, he never asked the question, well, what about me and my buddies? Maybe we're the ones who are messed up. Which, by the way, Paul Vitz, who was trained in Freudian psychology, I think he teaches at NYU now, he argues that it's not Christians who invent the father image, you know, invent God to worship, but he said first-generation militant, passionate atheists, without fail, have had either an absentee father or a hateful relationship with their father. Now, the thing is, you know, you could have a father-son, they love each other. If the father's an atheist, the son will probably become an atheist too. But they're that first-generation atheist, without fail, they had either a horrible or no relationship with their father. So Paul Vitz says, using Freudian terminology, you can't put Christians in one stereotypical psychological group and say, well, you've had a good relationship with your father, you'll probably become a Christian. You had a bad relationship with your father, you probably won't become a Christian. No, you get Christians with every possible relationship to their fathers, their mothers, every possible upbringing, brought up in all different world religions. Some were rich, some were poor. But with first-generation militant atheists, one after another, they either had no relationship with their father or a bad relationship with their father. And so So in using Freudian terminology, Paul Vitt says atheism is the psychological problem of trying to kill the father image. You hate all authority, whereas Christianity, you can't pin it down. It's just people from all different walks of life. But whatever the case, Freud spent so much time trying to explain away guilt. And he tried to come up with a myth that, you know, I doubt he believed in himself, but he said that the first primitive tribe was humans. There was one man and his many wives, and then their children. And the little boys grew up desiring to have sex with their mothers. Now, Freud, I don't know about other guys, I never desired to have sex with my mother. So if Freud felt that way, Freud's the one with the problem, okay? But whatever the case, little boys supposedly, they wanted to have sex with their fathers, with their mothers, but they were afraid of, because their father would kill them. So they banded together and killed their father. Then they felt guilty. This is what Freud, his theory there. They felt guilty for killing the father. So they chopped his body up and they ate him in a ritual meal. And then they were afraid of nature, earthquakes and floods and stuff like that. And they wished nature was a person so they could cry out for mercy. So what they did was they took the father image, they deified nature, so nature became Father God, and then they would offer sacrifices to Father God and pray to him. And then this is Freud's attempt to explain why we feel this thing universally called guilt. Okay? To me, it's much more reasonable, two things, much more reasonable that we feel guilt, because deep down inside, even when we sin in secret, we know that we have sinned against an all-seeing person, or persons, the three of them, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that guilt is real. If it's a universal thing, it's probably real. Okay? That's number one. And look at all the evil that guilt restrains. I mean, because you feel guilty about doing little sins, then it makes it easier for us to say no to big sins. If you never felt guilt, if you thought you can get away with murder, you try to get away with murder. The other factor there, he's spending so much time trying to explain away guilt, but in the end, these guys felt guilty because they killed their father. Well, he just pushed the question back. Why did they feel guilty? But there's no such thing as right and wrong. If killing your father isn't wrong, why did they feel guilty? Sigmund Freud, you haven't explained anything. His own explanation presupposes guilt is real, so that when the first group of guys killed their dad, they felt guilty. That's exactly what you're supposed to explain away, and it's part of your explanation. So deep down inside, one of the strongest arguments for God's existence is you can try to claim up and down on a stack of Bibles that there is no such thing as God, there is no such thing as right and wrong, but when you do something wrong, deep down inside, you feel guilty. And that's why it is so scary when people like Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin learn how to stifle the voice of conscience within their hearts. I feel more comfortable about an atheist who is at least dialoguing with Christians because he wants answers. I feel more comfortable about him than somebody who calls him or herself a Christian and continues to willfully do things that they know are wrong. Because I don't want to know where they're going to be 2 or 3 years down the line if they don't repent. But the voice of conscience tells us, hey, we stand guilty before an all-holy God. Fear of death, okay? When's the last time you heard about somebody on their deathbed that called for their favorite atheist philosopher? You know, I'm dying, I know I'm going to die. Send me my favorite atheist philosopher. to talk to me and give me a few last words. No. Even atheists on their deathbeds, if they send for anybody other than their relatives, it's going to be a preacher or a priest. Yeah, yeah. It's like, now I don't even know if the story's true, but Aaron Burr, he was a real, real lowlife. Of all our founding fathers, he was like, I mean, Aaron Burr in some ways made Bill Clinton look like a Mother Teresa. So you can just let your imagination run wild with that. But Aaron Burr, he was an atheist, and he was like a grandson. He was related in some way to Jonathan Edwards. So he was the black sheep of the family. I mean, he came from a squared away family, and he was a loser. And but his wife was a Christian. He was unfaithful to his wife on a regular basis. And his daughter was dying. His little daughter was dying. And she asked him, she said, "Daddy, who should I believe? Should I believe like you, or should I believe like Mom?" And without even batting an eye, without even thinking, he said, "Believe like your mother." Because he knew, you know, he knew. You believe like me, you die without hope. I want my little girl to die with hope, you know. And most likely, you know, with the family Aaron Burr had, most likely he knew deep down inside that God existed. He saw evidence for him. But most likely, he also knew that if God existed, he's got judgment coming for the life he was living. So a lot of people will reject God, and then because they reject God, then they reject morality. But some people, like Aaron Burr, reject God's morality, and then they say, "Well, but I don't believe in God." Because it's pretty tough to continue in sin knowing judgment is coming. Respect for human life. If we're mere molecules in motion and there is no God, okay, then why do we respect human life? Okay, if I walked outside and I kicked him out of the dirt, you know, you're not going to say when James comes back in the office on Monday morning or whatever, you're not going to come by and say, "Don't let Fernandez teach here again. He went out and kicked a mound of dirt," and then James is going to start crying. And "You mean an innocent mound of dirt?" And James just dropped to his knees and weeping. And no, it's like he would tell you, he would look you right in the eyes and say, "Dude, it was a mound of dirt. Who cares? Point it out to me, I'll kick it." You know. And but the fact of the matter is, atheism is true. Kicking a little innocent baby is no different than kicking them out in the dirt. Yet the atheists want the serial murderers locked up just like the Christians do. Now you tell me who's living consistently with the worldview and who's not. Respect for human life. I mean, you could add another one to that list. Free will and human responsibility. If only matter exists, we talked about this earlier, if only matter exists, then there's no such thing as free will and we're not responsible for our actions. If only matter exists, you know, just like my stomach was grumbling earlier, right? I couldn't help it. Granted, it was gross, but I mean, you're not going to condemn me, you know, because my stomach is doing a weird thing. I mean, if anything, you pray for me because you wonder that might be connected to some kind of physical ailment and stuff. But you're not going to, you know, my stomach was grumbling. It's like, the poor guy can't control it, you know. But it's the same if we don't have an immaterial soul, the real you, that makes decisions, makes choices, and then that acts upon the human brain, and that gets the ball rolling so that we do whatever we do, then we can't be held responsible for our actions. So we got to let all the terrorists out of prison. We got to let all the murderers and the rapists out of prison because they were just doing what they had to do. It was biologically determined. Yet, atheists can't live consistently with that. I mean, look at B.F. Skinner. B.F. Skinner was a psychologist who wrote a book, Beyond Freedom and Human Dignity. And what he argued, he was very Freudian in his thought, but he took it to a degree Freud never dreamed of. He said, look, if we are nothing but mere molecules in motion, then we really don't have free will. Our actions are biologically determined. And so he said that everything we do, everything we are, is determined by our genes, our genetic information, and our environment. So then B.F. Skinner said, me and my intellectual buddies, the intellectual elite, we need to genetically manipulate human beings, you know, through genetic engineering, and through our wisdom, control their environment so that we'll bring about the best possible world. Okay? So Francis Schaeffer, when he refuted that, he referred to that as the death of man, where man's going to be treated like non-man. And he refuted it in a small book called Back to Freedom and Human Dignity, where he argued there's basically two things wrong with B.F. Skinner's view. One is, if the masses are controlled by their genes and their environment, then so are B.F. Skinner and his intellectual elite buddies. Okay? They're controlled. They're not free either. So the ideas they come up with are no better than the ideas that Hitler came up with or anybody else. Okay? They're as controlled as the masses are. And then number two, in B.F. Skinner's world, there is no such thing as good and evil, so how could there be such a thing as the best possible world? Any direction the world heads in is as good as any other. Okay? But whatever the case, if we believe only matter exists, there's no such thing as free will, we're not responsible for our actions. But if we have a non-material soul, where we really make our choices, okay, then we can be held responsible for our actions. Our whole penal system, our whole prison system is based upon the assumption that human beings are responsible for their actions. Okay? Then if you look at Pascal's wager, and so, you know, basically when we look at these different aspects of human experience, mere molecules and motions combined with time and chance cannot explain any of these factors. The atheist can look at these factors and say these factors are real, however they're just there. Well, then atheism becomes a non-worldview, an anti-worldview, a non-explanation. Or they could say, no, those things appear to be real, but they're illusions, they're not really there. Then I would argue that that these things are more obviously real than the atheistic worldview. Now with Pascal's wager, you can map it out here, that Pascal's saying, look, if you wager against, by wagering against God, what he means is, if you live your life as if God doesn't exist, you wager for God, you live your life as if he does exist, you seek, wagering for God means you seek God with all your heart, you look for it. Pascal believes if you seek God with all your heart, you'll find him. Jeremiah 29:13. If you decide not to even look for God, or to assume he doesn't exist, either way, you're wagering against God. So if you wager against God and you lose everything, infinite loss. If you wager against God and you win absolutely nothing. So no chance at winning anything, yet there's a chance of losing everything. But if you wager for God and you win everything. It's an infinite game. But if you wager for God and you lose nothing. That's why Blaise Pascal says the wise man will always seek God, and when he finds him, he will serve him. Okay? So basically, I could see a person being an atheist but hoping he's wrong, and talking with Christians and reading books and trying to find evidence that God exists. That would be like the person whose 2-year-old baby is lost in the woods. He keeps searching and hoping. But for an atheist to say, I'm done searching, I'm not going to search anymore, and I'm proud to be an atheist, and then put a bumper sticker on their car and try to destroy as many Christians' faith as they can, that doesn't make any sense at all. You know? What do you do? I mean, if you convince a professing Christian to become an atheist, you say, okay, good, now we should rejoice because we're both going to die and cease to exist. I don't know, it does not make any sense to me. So any questions at all about or comments about some of the clues for God's existence, some of the evidence for God's existence? Many, not all, many traditional apologists would take just one or two of these arguments and try to make that their whole case for God's existence, and they would act like it, to reject the premises and the conclusion of this argument involves contradiction or whatever. That's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm looking at are just little clues to the existence of God, and you add these little clues up, each and every one of them, it's more reasonable to believe that God exists than he doesn't exist. Yeah.
Even if God wasn't there, people would still have some inherent goodness. And this actually is a modern Christian. Because I was telling her about Nihilism and if God didn't exist, then that's what there's no moral aspect. She's saying, well, that's not necessarily true. I think if God wasn't there, we would still be good.
You know, I would have to just define what good is. If there's no good with a capital G, everything that is good flows from God's good nature. So I'd like to know where good comes from. Like, for instance, if a person is an evolutionist, did good evolve from primordial soup? You know, the law of non-contradiction, the laws of logic, and moral laws, did they evolve from primordial soup? Where did they come from? This is furniture that is extremely weird, to say the least, in a universe without God. God, by definition, is good. Okay? Plato came very close to this. He acknowledged the existence of the good, and all the other ideas flowed from that. The weird thing was he made his god, the demiurgos, a lesser god that formed the world out of pre-existing matter. It would seem to me he would have been better off making the good his god rather than the demiurgos. But whatever the case, even a non-Christian like Plato had to acknowledge there had to be the good with a capital G to make sense out of goodness with a small g. I would just keep it. Sometimes we don't have to come up with the answers. Christianity, that is the answer. Sometimes all we got to do is just come up with the questions. Well, how do you know that? You know, this Bill Jack of Worldview Academy, he drives me nuts when I watch his videos. I see him tearing apart in love these poor atheists and New Agers. But all he does, he never says anything. He just stands there and says, yeah, but how do you know that? And they might give two or three answers that sound smart, but once you get beyond the outer shell, they start getting embarrassed. Yeah, but how do you know that? Well, I think people can be good. Even if there was no God, they could be good. Well, how do you know that? Or how do you define good? What is good? You know, and you just go on, and eventually these people are reduced to, you know, it's like the emperor has no clothes. You find out their worldview has no clothes. It's like, you know, a table, and you're trying to explain that it has legs, and you find out there's no legs. There's nothing supporting your table. It's going to come crashing down. Another tip too. Here's what atheists like to do. My cumulative case. Read that closely. In no other God, because what atheists like to do, they like to say, "Look, you've used your moral argument for God that didn't. I think that could prove." The atheists will say, "I think that could prove the existence of many gods." Or of a deistic God. But you haven't proved Christianity, or you haven't proved the monotheism. And they walk away and it's like, whoa, hold on a second here. If it could also prove deism, besides monotheism, deism, or polytheism, any one of those three scenarios, atheism loses. Get back here. Okay? So they act like we have to prove with absolute certainty God's existence in argument. If there's any way out, they're allowed to take it and move on. Okay? So what the atheist does, they try to say, okay, look, I know some questions that you Christians can't answer. And believe me, there are a lot of them. Okay? Like a guy pointing to a husband and wife and saying, their six-week-old baby just died. I had to do the funeral of my nephew. I think he was only 7 weeks old. For some reason, they went with an open casket. I'm trying to preach his funeral, and there's that little open casket. Looked like a little healthy boy. The only thing was wrong. It wasn't moving at all. And now, can I explain to you exactly why God allowed that to occur? No. But does that mean I should become an atheist? Because at least I could say, you know, if we didn't blow it in the garden, that would not have happened. The atheist can't say that. Whatever it is. So what atheists are trying to do, they're trying to say, look, we found that 5% of the big questions, Christians don't know the answer. And the Bible doesn't address those. 5% of the big questions. So you should stop being a Christian. My response ought to be, oh yeah, and then what? Become an atheist with the answer, 0% of the big questions? See, we're too nice of people. Okay? If we can't answer a question, we allow the atheist to just dwell on that. In the meantime, he hasn't answered 50 of our questions and we let him off the hook. We're not doing him a favor by doing that. We've got to remind them how weak their worldview is. Okay? So, I call it the fallacy of piling on. Do not allow atheists to commit the fallacy of piling on. That's when all of a sudden you're debating an atheist and all of a sudden he starts bringing up, he starts bringing his New Age, deistic friends, his polytheistic friends, pantheistic friends, and they pile on. It's like 50 worldviews against Christianity. That's not fair. That even the truth will look, if you bring all these falsehoods and pile up on the truth, it's hard to see that the truth is true. So I say, look, it's mano-a-mano, one-on-one, okay, monotheism versus atheism. Let's examine these different aspects of human experience, and each of them will try to figure out which is more reasonable. So we're not saying, okay, the universe had a beginning and needs a cause, therefore that proves monotheism. It just shows monotheism is superior, is a more plausible explanation than atheism. And when you see that happening time and time again, why should I reject that which is very plausible for that which is totally implausible? Okay? So do not let them off the hook. Another thing is atheist love. I accused Michael Martin of throwing rocks at the Christian worldview, but refusing to give his address because he knows he lives in a glass house. So I'm going to throw rocks at your house, Fernandez, but I'm not telling you where I live, because if you find out where I live, you'll start throwing rocks, and I got a glass house. It's going to come tumbling down. Okay? Don't allow them to do that. Michael Martin refused to admit what view of moral values he held to. See, the atheist like saying, I don't have any beliefs. I'm willing to come and debate you. No, I don't have any beliefs, so I don't have to defend anything. I can just throw rocks at you. Hey, with rules like that, you can take the weakest worldview on earth and make it look good. If he gets to throw rocks at us all day long, then we're not allowed to throw any back. But he wouldn't say what theory of knowledge he held to, because he doesn't have one. He wouldn't say what theory of moral values he holds to. He probably has one or two views there, but if he admits what they are, then it's easy to refute them, okay? So that's another thing you want to try to avoid. But don't allow them. Just one-on-one. You know, I'll debate you today, and then I'll get your New Age pantheist friend tomorrow. And we'll see which is a stronger worldview, theism or New Age pantheism. So that's basically what I'm saying. See, the thing is, I don't try to argue for absolute certainty. I don't even try to argue for God's existence and the truth of Christianity beyond all reasonable doubt. Okay? That's what you got to do in a criminal court, to argue beyond all reasonable doubt that this guy committed the murder and therefore he should go to the electric chair. All the defense has to do is raise 2 or 3% down, and that guy goes free. Okay? Look at the O.J. Simpson case. You get enough money, the lawyers throw out all these wild conspiracy theories, but you get enough down, and the guy goes free. The guy walks. Okay? We got to get out of the criminal courts. It's not fair, because we're debating somebody else here. Why, if the atheist raises 2 to 3% down, he wins the debate? No. Let's bring it to the civil courts, where it's the preponderance of evidence. See, I'm not talking about winning debates. I'm talking about winning souls. Okay? But the preponderance of evidence, what that means is, whichever worldview is more reasonable, then the other one wins. And when we break it down, like, so in other words, what I'm saying is, atheists have controlled the day so long, they set up the rules. And the rules are stacked in their favor. Okay? You realize that among thinking atheists, there are none left? The thinking atheists are really agnostics. But because of the Big Bang model, and because it was pointed out to atheists that the only way to know with certainty that God does not exist, the only way to prove God does not exist with absolute certainty, you'd have to be all-knowing, all-seeing, you basically would have to be God, so self-refuting. So what atheists have done is they've redefined atheism. So atheism no longer means no God, a theos. It's now no knowledge of God. We lack knowledge of God. Okay? But that's agnosis. That's agnostics, no knowledge. So they're really agnostics. They're not really atheists. So they redefine atheism. Michael Martin is Atheism, a Philosophical Justification. He has a whole appendix where he explains what he means by atheism. He calls it soft atheism. It's not soft atheism. Atheism means the belief there is no God, the rejection of belief in God. What he defines it as is agnosticism. We don't know. We lack knowledge of God. And so basically, by doing that, the reason why they do that is they say, well, the burden of proof is on you, Christian. You believe something. I don't have any beliefs in this matter. It's like, look, you would not have showed up for the debate if you had no beliefs in this matter. So they're saying, you say there is a God. I say I haven't seen enough evidence for God. But I don't really have a view. I'm not biased like you. I don't have a worldview I'm defending. See, they've taken atheism from the positive statement, there is no God, and they've reduced it to lack of belief in God. But if they really just lack belief in God, they wouldn't take the bait. They take the bait because they do have a worldview. But and so what they're doing is they're trying to say the burden of proof is on you to prove something that you believe when I just lack belief in that area. So it enables them to be on the offensive, and it forces us on the defense right off the bat. What we have to say is that's why when I debated Michael Martin, he tried to get me moving that direction. I said, no, you don't understand, Dr. Martin. This debate is theism versus atheism. That's why I would not debate an atheist of his stature with the question, does God exist? Because then he can claim, you're arguing the affirmative, the burden of proof is on you. So I want theism versus atheism, which is 50-50. And all I got to do is tilt the scale in favor of theism, and theism wins. So all I'm saying is, let's try to get the atheist to debate using fair rules. Okay? And when you're witnessing with somebody, all it might be doing is just plant a little seed here, plant a little seed there. You know, if the guy you're debating or dialoguing with is a big mouth, you might say, hey, it's a victory if I can just get 5 minutes in out of every hour. Okay? Because in the end, you know, we're talking about debates, and it's not about winning debates, it's about leading people to Christ. So in the end, if you have to win a soul, if you have to lose a debate, then lose a debate. Okay? But, so we're not trying to win debates. At the same time, if we can answer their objections and plant seeds, it will go a long way. But if we're looking for 50-50, some atheists are not going to give it to us. Now let me just say a few things briefly about creation versus evolution. This we don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to touch on this. First off, here's a problem with evolution. Modern science was founded by Christians. I mean, why didn't atheists begin modern science? Because there isn't, the atheistic worldview doesn't have any foundation for modern science. Even the ancient Greeks that did science, there was always the possibility. It was like, you know, Aristotle would be studying stuff, and then somebody would come up to him and say, you know, do you ever think that maybe our senses deceive us? And Aristotle would say, yeah, I think about that all the time, but let's just not think about that. Let's discover more things. Yeah, but the things we discover, they might not be true. I know, but let's do the best we can. That there was always that humility within ancient science, because there was no guarantee that our senses were really giving us true information about the world in which we live. All of a sudden, the Christian worldview rises to the top, becomes the dominant worldview in Western civilization. Next thing you know, we founded modern science, where all of a sudden we have confidence that our senses are not deceiving us. Why? Because the founders of modern science were Bible-believing Christians, Galileo, Descartes, Pascal, Isaac Newton, Johannes Kepler. They were Bible-believing Christians. They believed that a rational God created humans in his image, so we're rational beings, so that through human reason, he created the world in a way that makes sense, so that through human reason, we really could find truth about the world in which we live. Okay? Without the Christian worldview, modern science would have never started. Jackie, out of, last name is Jackie, is it, I don't know, Stephen Jackie, I can't remember his first name, out of Seton Hall, a philosophy professor out there has gone a long way with that, a great philosopher of science. But basically what atheists have done, they have removed the foundation for modern science, the confidence we have in modern science, the guarantee that the world is not an illusion deceiving us. They've removed that foundation, God, and they act like, okay, business as usual, let's just keep moving forward. It's like, no. Even C.S. Lewis predicted in the 1940s that eventually science, which is an attempt to control nature, is going to try to control the last aspect of nature, and that is man himself, and that laws, once God's laws are rejected, the government will make its own man-made laws which serve no purpose but protecting those in positions of power. And that's when C.S. Lewis says we will have produced men without chests, men without moral consciences, the abolition of man. Okay? And so, basically, the only thing C.S. Lewis argued, science and magic are almost synonymous. They both try to control nature. The only thin line between the two is belief in God and adherence to his moral laws. Once they go out the window, science becomes superstition, and a superstition that enables the few to enslave the billions, in the language of C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man. But modern science was founded by Christians. That's more than a coincidence. The beginning of the universe, both the Big Bang, which is almost universally accepted by scientists today, though I have some questions with it, and the second law of thermodynamics, entropy, energy deterioration, showed the universe had a beginning. That's a problem for evolutionists. I mean, the atheists used to argue the universe doesn't need a cause because it didn't have a beginning. That we already talked about first life. A single-celled animal has enough genetic information to fill a huge library. You don't get that amount of information by chance. Intelligent intervention is needed. Then you get the more complex life forms, like the human brain, the most complex physical thing we find in the universe, the fossil record. In the fossil record, new complex life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. You don't have arms turning into wings or vice versa, okay? There's no undisputed transitional form, missing link found in the fossil record. You don't have reptiles to birds. For that to occur, you realize for reptiles to evolve into birds, it would take an entirely different makeup of the lungs, the breathing apparatus, so that whatever the transitional form would be, it wouldn't be able to breathe. Because organs don't work unless they're fully developed. Apes to humans, all the transitional forms between apes and humans have been refuted. Most of them turned out to be either modern man, or modern man with a bone disease like rickets. Some turned out to be what? One was the tooth of an extinct pig that was in a monkey trial. Another turned out to be a horse. Many turned out to be extinct apes. Okay, embarrassment after embarrassment after embarrassment. Yet nobody wants to update our textbooks. We still show little monkeys turning into big monkeys, turning into a naked man at the end of the page, and we just forget to tell our high school and college students that all these missing links have been called into question. Whatever the case, so you have those problems, and the sixth problem there is the many unproven assumptions of evolution. Okay? Listen to what they assume. They assume these. They do not prove these. Okay? They either assume the universe is eternal, very few evolutionists now hold for that, or the universe popped into existence from nothing totally without a cause. That's assumed. It's not proven. I mean, it would be proven if scientists could just stand in a lab and under lab conditions all of a sudden say, whoa, something else just popped into existence. Totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. Wow, that does happen. But it doesn't. And they know it doesn't. If it did, science would be dead, by the way. If things just popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause, then even forensic science, crime scene investigation, you walk into a room, there's a guy laying on the floor with a knife in his back. And it's like, the knife could have just popped into existence totally without a cause and could have shown up in his back. We have no evidence to convict the fingerprints of the guy, of the suspect, could have just popped into existence. And I think we have nothing to go on here. Okay? And then, by the way, this is why Christians were the founders of modern science. They believed in a world that makes sense. Life from coming from non-life without intelligent intervention. You know, in science textbooks, college textbooks, they read biology textbooks that the cell is the most basic unit of life, and all the cell theory, all presently existing cells evolved from other cells, except for the first cell, which had to have evolved from non-living material. Now, the cell theory they prove that all cells came from previous existing cells, but then they just assume, of course, this doesn't apply to the first cell, the first living cell, because that had to have evolved from non-living material. Where's the evidence for that? There is no evidence for that, but they have to assume it. Because if you have no God, the only other thing you have before living things is non-living material. So they assume it just came from there. If you just assume God's existence, then the cell theory makes sense. You don't need to start... Evolutionists constantly have to violate their own scientifically established natural laws. So life from non-life without intelligent intervention, intelligence from non-intelligence. When atheist takes a debate, he's acknowledging the existence of intelligence. He's claiming to be intelligent, okay? But do we really think intelligence, a non-material thing like intelligence, evolved from primordial soup? Multi-celled animals came from single-celled animals. No, I mean, they talk about mutations, okay? Mutations garble the existing genetic code. It adds no new information. So if the genetic code were like the 26 letters of the alphabet, it wouldn't add a 27th, mutation wouldn't add a 27th, 28th, 29th letter. It would just garble the order of those letters. So where did a single-celled animal get genes, the genetic information for teeth? You need new information. Mutations do not give you new information. Animals with backbones from animals without backbones, no evidence for that. And then the common ancestry of fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals, all of this is assumed. None of it has been proven. Okay? Now let me ask you, if you had to sum that up in one word, the universe popping into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause, light coming from non-light, multi-celled animals from single-celled animals, vertebrae from invertebrate, the common ancestry of fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals. If you had to sum all of that in one word, anybody know what it would be?
Fairy tales?
Wait, fairy tales is good, but I'm looking for one word. And nonsense is another good word, but it's evolution.
Oh.
I just told you what evolution... This is evolution. In other words, when everything's said and done, they've proven that dogs change a little, but stay dogs. And cats change a little, but stay cats. They've never proven that reptiles really did evolve into birds. Everything that you would need to prove evolution, every major jump is assumed and not proven. And so what that tells us is the many unproven assumptions of evolution tell us that evolution itself is an unproven assumption. A problem of evil and human suffering, we'll talk about that next week. Or next month, just we'll talk about the two problems and then you can read the responses.